But first, JCT Jennings and his friends at Lynberry Court Preparatory School make a return to BBC Radio 4 as Mark Williams begins a five-part reading of Jennings' Little Hut by Anthony Buckeridge.
It was only a little hut, but Jennings was very proud of it. He crouched in the low doorway, and a glow of happiness warmed him as his gaze drifted round the draughty interior. Of course, it was still rather muddy, he thought. But they could use the planks of the front door for duckboards until they had finished digging the patent drain on the marshy side of the floor. The roof was rather thin on top, and the walls were on the bald side too, but they could easily stop the wind whistling through by collecting a few more reeds and branches. And until Derbyshire had finished making his famous ventilating shaft out of that disused drainpipe, it was just as well that they had got air-conditioned walls. All around him, Jennings could hear sounds of activity as neighbouring hut-builders cocooned themselves in their reedy igloos. They had been quick to copy his idea and claim squatters' rights, but it was he who had thought it all out in the first place. The grounds of Lynberry Court Preparatory School were spacious. The main buildings were grouped round the quadrangle. Then came the cricket pitches, the headmaster's garden, and stretches of rough grassland. Past these, and reaching to the limits of the 40-acre estate, was the wood. And in the wood was the pond. It was an obliging sort of pond that seemed to ask for exciting tracking games to be played round it, and the shrubs and bulrushes growing about its banks almost implored people to build huts in them. Jennings and Derbyshire were building a hut together, and they had made up their minds that it was going to be the finest residence in the whole colony when it was finished. It was Jennings' third term at Lynberry, and he was nearly 11. He was an eager, rather impetuous boy, with a wide-awake look in his eyes and a head of brown hair that no comb could keep parted for long. As he knelt on the soggy clay floor, loud metallic bangings came from an inner compartment at the far end of the hut. "Don't kick up such a frantic hoo-ha, Derbyshire," Jennings called. "Can't you hammer a bit more quietly?" From the inner sanctum, a pink and white face, topped with fair curly hair, peered out. It was a serious face, with spectacles. "I'd like to see you do better," it said. "It's pretty tricky making a patent prefabricated ventilating shaft when you've only got your shoe to hammer with." The craftsman crawled through into the larger room, trailing a piece of drainpipe behind him. "I bet nobody else has got a patent prefabricated ventilating shaft in their hut." "Neither would we if you hadn't sat on it and bent it," replied Jennings. "I was going to get a small hunk of mirror and make it into a periscope so as we could see people coming." "You don't need a periscope for that," Derbyshire objected. "You can see people coming through the gaps in the reeds." Jennings and Derbyshire's hut boasted a cane-seated rustic chair made from broken branches and bulrushes. It was perfectly safe, provided that no one actually sat on it. There was also a pair of bicycle handlebars salvaged from the pond and now in use as a hat stand. They were still searching, hopefully, for a hat to hang on it. There was a bookshelf, a boot scraper, and on the wall a sugar sack with the words, "Welcome to ye olde worldy hut," picked out in a tasteful variety of colours. A thick black head of hair appeared in the hut. It was Bromwich Major. They showed him the patent prefabricated ventilating shaft. Bromwich shrugged. "Come and see what I've got in my hut," he said. The only way to enter Bromwich's hut was to lie down and slide through a hole in the reeds. Inside, the visitor found himself in a natural hollow of the ground, which had been roughly roofed in. Even in the dim-lit interior, Jennings saw it. Balanced on a broken cake stand, in the middle of the floor, was a tank of water. And in the tank was a goldfish. "Gosh, how super cracking sonic," declared Jennings with excitement. "Wherever did you get it from?"
"My mother brought it down by car yesterday," Bromwich explained. "It took her years to get here. She could only drive it about 4 miles a fortnight in case she spilt the water. You can keep your patent prefabricated ventilating shafts."
"Thank you," said Derbyshire. "We were going to."
"All I want is Elmer," cried Bromwich with fierce pride. Who? Queried Derbyshire. Elmer, that's my fish's name. Why?
Why?
Well, why not? Why are you called Derbyshire?
Oh, that's easy to explain. My father says that years ago my family used to be known as...
All right, Jennings broke in. We don't want your family history right back to William the Conk.
A whistle sounded in the distance.
Come on, said Bromwich. There's Mr. Carter blowing the all in.
You know, Derby, Jennings said, as they followed Bromwich out of his hut, a pet like that is just the right sort of thing for a boarding school. He can't escape. You don't have to take him for walks, and he doesn't eat much. You can't go wrong with a goldfish, can you?
I bet you could, his friend answered. He little knew how near the truth he was. By now, bodies were emerging from huts and hurrying towards the slope which led to higher ground. There was a quagmire at the foot of the slope, where the pond had overflowed across the path, and here the pioneer hut builders had erected the Derbyshire Pontoon Suspension Bridge. Single-line traffic and no overtaking was the rule, and the traveller had to swing himself across an awkward gap with the aid of an overhanging branch. The bottleneck had slowed the hurrying tide of hut builders to a snail-paced crawl. Mr. Carter's whistle sounded again, impatiently this time, as the boys waited their turn to cross.
"Oh, gosh, this is frantic," moaned Derbyshire. "If we're not back when the dawn bell goes, the head will put the pond out of bounds."
"It was jolly decent of Mr. Carter to ask the Archbeco to let us build huts," said Jennings. "It's not often you find grown-ups who are keen on huts. They seem to turn against things like that when they get old."
"Mr. Carter's not old," protested Derbyshire.
"Oh, he is. He's at least 25 or 30. More than that, probably. I happen to know for a fact that he was alive in the olden days before they'd invented jet-propelled aircraft and coupons for sweets." In single file, the hut builders picked their way across the pontoon suspension bridge and ran full tilt past the cricket pitches. Mr. Carter was waiting for them on the quad. Seen at close quarters, the master did not appear to be the sole surviving relic of a bygone age that Jennings' description had suggested. He was in his early 30s, a friendly, unhurried sort of man who remained calm amidst all the excitements which ruffled the surface of boarding school life.
"How are the huts progressing?" he inquired.
"They're going fine, sir," Jennings told him. "And we're learning masses of natural history and botany, sir."
"Really?" marvelled Mr. Carter. "Such as?"
"Well, sir, I've learnt you can cut your finger on bulrushes, and you can't keep newts out of a hut, however many anti-reptile traps you dig around it, sir."
"I see. Well, there's one point you better bear in mind. If anyone gets his feet wet, or falls into the pond, or even gets stuck in an anti-reptile trap, it will mean the end of hut building. The head's most particular about you not getting dirty and spoiling your clothes."
"Yes, sir," chorused the hut builders, trying to edge behind one another in their efforts to conceal muddy socks and pond-slimed shoes. A few days later, Jennings and Derbyshire were on their way to their hut, when they were hailed by Atkinson, who occupied a little hut near the water's edge.
"Ah, Jen, I'll be looking for you," he cried. "Brummer's got the mumps."
"Oh, that is Ozzard," said Jennings. "He sent you an urgent message via matron via me to you about his goldfish. He's not allowed to have it in the sanatorium, and he's as sick as mud at having to leave it behind because he's so spivishly devoted to it. It's like his next of kin, as you might say. He wants you to look after it."
Jennings pondered for a moment. Taking care of a fish who boasted a next of kin was a serious business, and not to be undertaken lightly. At the same time, it was gratifying to think that he had been chosen for this position of trust. Clearly, it was his duty to shoulder this burden so that Bromwich could enjoy his mumps with an easy mind.
"All right," he said.
Jennings and Derbyshire fetched the tank and carefully carried it back to their own hut, together with a tin of fish food.
"Does he look all right to you?" Jennings asked Derbyshire.
"I don't know," replied Derbyshire, peering into the tank. "He keeps going to action stations and submerging all in one breath. I don't like the look of it at all. Perhaps he's caught mumps from Bromo." Jennings shook his head. "No, I don't think he's ill at all. I think he's just feeling restless and needs a spot of exercise. After all, if you had to live in a titchy little tank, you'd get a bit browned off."
"Perhaps it is a bit cruel keeping him cooped up," said Derbyshire.
"Why don't we let him have a decent swim?" suggested Jennings. "Not in the pond, of course. He might get bitten by a moorhen. But we could let him do a couple of lengths in the swimming pool."
"Well," said Derbyshire doubtfully, for the suggestion bristled with snags. "If we did that, how would we get him out again?"
"We could put him in your butterfly net, Darby," declared Jennings triumphantly. "There's masses of time after prep. I'll collect Elmer, and you get your butterfly net, and then we'll get cracking on exercise goldfish."
"Not exercise goldfish," corrected Derbyshire.
"You mean operation goldfish. You only call it exercise when it's a practice, and this is the real thing."
"Well, in this case, the real thing is to give Elmer some exercise.
So we'll call it Operation Exercise."
Shortly after evening preparation, when there was still a clear half-hour before bedtime, Jennings staggered round the corner to the swimming pool with a goldfish tank in his arms. Derbyshire was waiting for him, with his butterfly net and the key, and furtively they let themselves in. Carefully, the fish was transferred to the butterfly net and lowered into the none-too-clean water. Jennings held the handle and moved slowly along the edge of the pool. It was a great success to start with, and as Jennings pointed out, everything was going swimmingly. Derbyshire lowered his voice to a respectful whisper.
"I expect he's wondering where he's got to, don't you?
He had a sort of puzzled look on his face when I popped him in the net. Perhaps you'd better check he's all right."
Jennings jerked the net clear of the murky water. It was empty. For some seconds the two boys stood staring in horrified amazement, while little driblets of water trickled down the mesh and dripped back into the pool. Then, when the first impact of the shock was over, and the boys inspected the net at close quarters, they found a medium-sized hole in the bottom.
"Oh, heavens! Bromo will never forgive us if anything happens to Elmer," moaned Derbyshire.
"He can't have swam far yet. Let's see if we can see him," said Jennings. "The water's a bit dirty, though. We would wait till it's nearly time to have it changed. I can't see the bottom at all."
The water was certainly cloudy. The bath was a small one, and Robinson, the odd job man, changed the water every 3 weeks, and judging by the state of it on that fateful Tuesday evening, the bath was more than ready for its 3 weekly renewal. Jennings and Derbyshire knelt down and peered into the murky depths. Once, Jennings caught a glimpse of a golden streak near the surface, but the fish was more than an arm's length from the side. Jennings grabbed the net and leant over the side while Derbyshire grabbed his friend's ankles, but by that time, Elmer was out of range and out of sight.
"I wonder whether we could lure him to the side with bait," Jennings pondered.
While Jennings kept guard, Derbyshire fetched a tin of fish food and a flower pot full of worms. Jennings sprinkled the fish food on the water and submerged the flower pot in the butterfly net. It was all in vain. No fin rippled the surface, no jaws rose to take the bait.
"Oh, gosh! This is Ozzard," cried Derbyshire in despair. "Why do these frantic hoo-hahs always have to pick on us to happen to?"
Mark Williams was reading the first part of Jennings' Little Hut by Anthony Buckridge, abridged by Roy Apps. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4 by David Blount, and Jennings' adventures continue at the same time tomorrow.